Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM with me, William English. This afternoon, we are joined by artist Reto Scheiber. I met Reto at the St. Martin's graduation show, which was, a couple of months ago now?
Yeah, it was 1 month, more or less one month ago.
Sort of September.
Yeah.
And Reto was, you've presumably just graduated from St. Martin's.
St. Martin's, yes.
And this was the MA Fine Art degree show. And as I walked around the show, I was struck by Reto's installation, which...
Called the Godhead, yeah.
It's called the Godhead. Hmm. And it seemed to be entirely abstract. It was like, it involved a video and...
Painting and sculpture.
Right.
So in one room there was a video called Jesus because of an experience I had 7 years ago.
Yeah.
And the other space was an installation, a light space installation called the Godhead.
Yeah. And the video piece was it almost looks like an ice cube revolving, but it's black and white.
Yeah.
And I was struck by the title because the title was Jesus, and it's a sort of piece that you might ordinarily you'd think, well, it's going to be called Untitled Number One or something like this. And so when I asked you, I said, well, why is it called Jesus? And you sort of went into this explanation, which seemed interesting. Can you enlarge on that?
Yeah, I can explain a little bit. I mean, my tutor quite often gave me other possibilities of titles, but I always actually rejected because I really was thinking I need to be straight because it was about Jesus, that experience which I had 7 years ago. And I mean, it was.
Why do you think the tutors tried to suggest other titles?
I think because being not too academic with the title Jesus, or being not so straight, a little bit more kind of. Intellectual or whatever.
Yeah.
But I just was thinking I have to call the video piece Jesus because of the particular experience I made. And if you like, I can now also a little bit explain.
Absolutely. Yes. I'd be fascinated to hear the story.
I mean, I was a couple of years depressed 7 years ago. And
this was when you were still in Switzerland.
Still in Switzerland,
You were about 25 then or so?
Yeah, with 25, I think it started to become worse with this depression. And I think I was always a kind of searching person, and I was always interested in supernatural things also. And at this time, I was kind of... in a position in which I really was very angry about everything, especially about God and about myself and about the whole world, I think. And I think this kind of structure was in it.
So you say when you say you were angry with God,
yeah.
Do you mean so? Presumably, you believed in God at that time, but you were angry.
I was always confronted with believers in my family, and they also were trying also to explain me more about this Jesus. But actually, I was not really interested because I was kind of a. Searching in another direction because I wanted to become an artist, I wanted to become a musician, whatever. And the only thing I was depressed. So I just was thinking,
Do you know why you were depressed at this time? Or?
At this time, because also I was quite often rejected through art colleges. I was trying to get in as I was 15. I was trying to get in as I was 21. And I think these two rejections lines me on to become kind of.
So what were you doing at this time when you couldn't, presumably you didn't get into art school or university from the age of 15? What were you doing then?
I was actually working at this time as a painter and decorator, but I always knew that I was kind of more interested to make art, which were then also exhibited in a gallery or a mm-hmm. museum or whatever. But I just didn't get the chance to make a proper education. Mm. So then I was just angry about everything, and I think I hated actually my situation. And then after this, as I was 25, I think the depression became worse than ever before. And I think I was then in this kind of position till I was 28. And at this time, I was then also thinking about to make a definite end to my life.
Really?
Okay. Yeah.
But so you thought about, you were thinking about suicide?
Yeah.
Was it seriously going to kill yourself, or was it just...
Yeah, the plans or the thoughts I had in my head were already quite concrete. Mm-hmm. And I was living at this time also in a flat, which was in the fifth floor. And I mean, I think it wouldn't be a problem to get killed if you jump out of the fifth floor. But at the same time, I also had quite often a voice in my head which told me you shouldn't do that, because I was quite often also confronted with a Christian woman which was part of the company I worked. Uh-huh. And then I think it was then also at this time as I just called her once, and then she told me, okay, come and we can talk. And this was actually the first time I really felt like in an island of peace, because I think that the Holy Spirit, which was already living in her, actually influenced also me. And then I was then quite often going to her, and I think it was much better than to go to the psychologist, which actually didn't have the right answer for my specific question.
What did the psychologist say?
The psychologist said probably what he learned about his Freudian theories. Hmm. I can't remember a lot of things, but he didn't come to the point, because I was always asking him also about God, and he was actually not a believer at all, and I think he just didn't have the right questions or the right answers. But the lady called Angela had the right answers for me, and then I just quite often went to her. And
were you on medication from?
I was on medication. Yeah.
And how was that? Did that do? Did that improve you? Or?
I think it just kind of protected me to probably to jump out.
Right.
But okay. I think it was not a particular help at this time. You didn't get the answer through medication. But what Angela did, she gave me then a prayer, which I prayed as I went home once. And it was more something like asking God for forgiveness and asking him to sit on the throne on which I was sitting, I think, 28 years. And it is more like to repent of a life which I lived without him, accusing him also for things which didn't work in my life.
So the prayer was for forgiveness, you say?
Yeah.
For what do you think you needed to be forgiven?
Yeah, actually, this I also didn't know, because I was thinking my life is anyway a little bit a mess, so why shouldn't ask? Should I ask for forgiveness? Hmm. But I actually didn't think too much about that part. I just was thinking, okay, I try and just look how it works. Mm. Probably something will happen. It is more like an experiment or something like that.
Mm.
What I did, I prayed then this prayer, and the first night nothing happens. But in the third night, then I was still in a kind of a position of waiting, expecting for something supernatural, and was lying on my bed. And then I just recognized a presence which entered my room. And it was like, becoming part of that presence, which was more like a glass of honey. And I was like swimming in that thick love of Jesus. And he actually washed all the bitterness and the hatred which I had inside of my heart kind of away. And I was also like a dry sponge lying on that bed. And I was thinking, okay, I was actually waiting for that presence 28 years. I think I was actually waiting for being forgiven for whatever. But then I actually understand why I had to pray that. Because it was like the way back to the Father through Christ. Because I experienced then that presence quite intense for 1 or 2 hours. This was just the first step. The second step was like being on an operation table and being operated through, I think it could be the Holy Spirit, because the Bible tells that he is also a person. He just cleaned every kind of dirt which was inside of my heart hidden. And he also took me after that part to a river. I could like see that with like in an invisible world. I could see that I was lying in a river and I get washed out of the last dirt which was inside of my heart. And then I could also kind of see that I was at the very end lying in a person's arms, and they kind of shaked me around and told me, okay, it wasn't like you thought 28 years of your life. Okay, yeah. It was not exact 28 years. I think it was three years. And then, it was like the opposite which I expected from God, because as I told you before, I was not agreeing with him. And after that, it was like standing on a very huge mountain, seeing the world from a 360 degrees perspective. And before, it was like being covered for years.
Right.
So it's like the opposite. It was like the light which came in inside of my darkness. Mm.
And is this the image that you use in your film?
Yeah.
Is of a like a revolving sort of glass cube.
It is.
Is this a sort of representation of this 360-degree turning on the hilltop?
Or it was also more like the light which shines in the darkness. So actually Jesus introduces himself also as the light. And so I think what I actually could experience then was the light which came into my life. And I wasn't depressed again after that night. I was completely healed. And it is kind of amazing, because it is actually only it is part of my life, and I have to make art of it. And I think in this MA year, it became more direct as I ever was before. Also with the topic, with the title, Jesus and the Godhead, I was thinking, okay, this anyway an experiment. and also just see how the people react on that kind of combination between minimal art and kind of Christian philosophy.
You were interested in music up until sort of heavy metal music, I think, until that.
I'm still interested in metal or hardcore or punk music, but nowadays there are quite a lot of bands which also have Christian lyrics. I mean, there are quite a couple of good bands in the hardcore scene. But before I was, I started to listen to music as I was 8 or 9 through a big collection from my brother, which is one of the biggest collectors in Switzerland. I think he has over 10,000 CDs or more. Yeah.
Wow. What of all sorts of music?
Mostly rock.
All right.
Mostly rock. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I did listen as I was 13 to bands like Metallica or Slayer or all that speed and thrash metal from America.
Mm.
I mean, I did enjoy the power which came out of this music.
You did enjoy
it? I did enjoy, because I love the power which comes out of the music still. But I think the lyrics they have are not always glorifying God. So
quite the opposite. Often,
the opposite. But at this time, I was also kind of interested in the supernatural. I'm still interested. So I could actually recognize some supernatural power behind, which was, of course, not God. But,
Okay. And then when you came to St. Martin's, how did they react to your philosophy?
I mean, at the very beginning, my tutor was asking me quite a few questions about why I'm doing that. Mm. And he, I think, was also trying to stop me. But on the second tutorial we had, he actually had to understand that I don't change my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I think after that he started to understand why I have to do that, because I think it is part of my art to deal with my past, and it is also a kind of a process which I'm still in it. But I think with this work I did in St. Martin's, I can say that I can't work it out now.
Right, but you must have been quite exceptional in that environment, I would think. Weren't you is it quite unusual, I would think, in a contemporary art scene?
I think it was unusual to come with a Christian kind of a topic. But in the same time, if you look back into our art history, I mean, the church wasn't always such quiet as it is now.
Mm.
If you look back 200 years, I think the strongest promoter of art was the church.
Yeah.
But this changed with our secular world, and also with atheism and with all that stuff we are living in nowadays. And
Okay. Now you've brought a CD with you, I think, which is perhaps could you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, it is a CD about a band from Switzerland, and especially the lead, the singer Felix, is a very good friend of mine, and this song is about also a prayer. He is quite often praying in this song, and it is actually a passage from another band called Salvation Street, but it was really attracting him that he actually took it over into the song.
What are they called? And what's it called?
The band called Lahar, And
the how do you spell L-A-H-A-R?
Yeah.
Okay.
.ch. All right. The website.
Yeah.
And
all right. Well, let's hear that. Let's hear a track from that.
The song is called Recover.
Recover.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, that was Swiss group Lahar.
Lahar, yeah.
Lahar from a CD. What's it called?
The CD called The Void.
Okay, and that means Recover, I think you said.
Yeah,
that's that track.
Song called Recover.
Okay, And that sort of that was sort of based also on a prayer, apparently, the lyrics.
Yeah, the lyrics are based on a prayer, mm-hmm. which is he repeating in this song.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so now you've finished at St. Martin's. You've got your MA in fine art.
Yeah.
What are you going to do now?
Actually, I decided to stay 1 or 2 years now in London. I also applied for a couple of jobs, and I'm in a position of waiting now. And also,
One of the jobs is as a verger, I think, isn't it? Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this could be quite a good mix between having the flat already included, because you got your own two-bedroom flat.
Right.
Actually, you have to take care of the building.
Okay.
And with my background, it is not really a problem to take care of a building.
Right.
So it could be a good combination.
So this is a church, a restoration.
It is a church, It is a church, simple schedule.
Okay, well, we've been joined today by Reto Scheiber, a Swiss artist who's been talking about his experiences with depression and finding recovery through religion, actually. So thank you very much for coming along and talking so frankly about it, actually.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
And, well, we'll play out. There's just 2 minutes left. This is Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM. And we'll just finish off with a track by Jim White called Pieces of Heaven, which is not that one.
Photographs you made. that the cow?
Yeah, cow man, Henry Cow.
Yeah, right, because I understand their legendary guitarist Fred Frith is playing at Club Integra on Thursday, 25th of October, at the Canterbury Arms, Canterbury Crescent, Brixton, right?
Also appearing, Superstrings, Julia Vorontsova, or Sartorial Binage.
With special guest dancers Maho and Impan. And DJ Chris Cornetto, yeah.
And Esoteric Projections by Rucksack Cinema.
Further details at www.divineagency.org, yeah.
Club Integral, quality music at low, low prices.
The Brown Lock Ensemble are live at LSO St Luke's, Old Street, London, EC1, on Saturday, the 20th of October 2007, at 8 p.m. Box office 0207 638 8891. Featuring Zoe Marklew, cello, Hugh Webb, harp, and Naye Ashworth, clarinet. With texts by Jan Stavinoa and Donald Rumsfeld, and variations on ideas by Ligeti, Varese, Zappa, and Glenn Gould. The Brian Locke Ensemble.
For the last half hour, you've been listening to William English and Wavelength. Coming up now, we actually have a very timely repeat. This is Alex Fitch and James D. Carteret's 50th London Film Festival. This was actually last year's edition of their examination of the festival in London. That's to coincide actually with today's episode of I'm Ready for My Close-Up, which is all about the 51st. Who is the London?
You're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Alex Fitch, and this is I'm Ready for My Close-Up. In a change to the advertised show, tonight I'm concluding my talk with James de Carteret, Alison Goldie, and Mark Stafford on the London Film Festival. With many of the films coming out in the regular cinema in the weeks and months to come, we're looking at the opening film, The Last King of Scotland, the concluding film, Babel, which showed this time last week, and everything in between.
Who is the London Film Festival aimed at? Because you're making it sound like it's all middle-class Guardian readers, which kind of defeats the purpose. I mean, they have a couple of events, you know, aimed at the wider London audience, like the thing in Trafalgar Square, Portrait of London, which was rubbish, but anyway, ignoring that. The 50 screen things, which they didn't advertise, but presumably showed four fairly accessible films, one of which was almost definitely Casino Royale. I don't know what the other three were.
Yeah.
And then quite a few kids' films. But, I mean, there are good A-list films out there that attract a wider audience. It's like my favourite film I saw last year was Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Yeah, you know, which was in the festival and was great. Yeah.
Exactly, but there was nothing like that this year. The only comparable thing was Stranger Than Fiction with Will Ferrell, and that looked rubbish. I mean, I don't know if it was or not.
No, it was good, but it was overly... I got the feeling that it could have been so much better. I mean, kind of disappointed, but it was still a good, fun, interesting...
I don't know, I just feel that since it's the 50th London Film Festival, they should have made some attempt, you know, to celebrate its Londonness. I mean, this, like, the thing they did in Trafalgar Square, they should have done that every night for the duration of the film festival and shown one film from each year of the past 50 years or something.
What a great idea.
Yeah, perhaps you're right.
And it's just absurd that they didn't, you know.
It's because people that I know, and it's probably the liberal intelligentsia in the main, you know, my mates, they are going to... Even a lot of them are barely aware of it. Oh, London Film Festival, you know, what?
And it's gone.
Yeah.
It seems to be all about the celebrity screenings and the media that they attract. You know, and you get those throughout the year anyway. Yeah. I mean, go to Leicester Square once a fortnight and you can, you know, shout at whatever A-list is walking past.
Tom Cruise.
And so to try and squeeze as many of those into a fortnight as possible, it's like...
On the other hand, having said that, the previously mentioned The Dog Pound, which I saw at the Ritzy, my local cinema, was packed.
Okay.
Yeah. An obscure Uruguayan sleep fest. Packed.
So I suppose in that sense, the London Film Festival is a badge of quality in a way that people wouldn't normally go and see maybe a film like that unless it was showing in the festival. And they think, oh, well, if they've listed it, maybe... it's worth our while.
Yeah, I mean, I was at screenings at sort of mid-afternoon or Wednesday after Wednesday, and, like, you know, at the Odeon West End, which holds, I don't know how many, 400 capacity or whatever it is, and it was like three quarters full, and that's wonderful.
It's pretty,
and
yeah,
it's some obscure sort of French film or some German film, whatever.
Oh.
And go on.
No, I just suddenly remembered one other big film, the opening gala thing. I saw The Last King of Scotland.
What was that like?
Huge and fantastic. It made you boilingly angry about the regime of Idi Amin. Forest Whitaker is quite amazing as Idi Amin, as one of those people who he was like, there's a line in it, you're like a child, that's what makes you terrifying, which is pretty much what he was like. It's got a great scene where one of his favourite bands from his regime, they've got to play live at his party scene in the film, do an African version of Me and Bobby McGee. and there's all this stuff running through it, which is fantastic, where he throws all the Asian people out of the country. It's one of the most famous debacles. You know, lots of people died because of this. And then gets angry later at people for not talking him out of it. And he got that horrible feeling of what it must be like to live under a man who wasn't just a despot and a tyrant, but a completely irrational despot and tyrant. And it turns quite nicely. At the same time, it does go through those, you know, despot, tyrant, movie cliche, the well-worn liberal films about, say, South Africa or whatever. It goes through a lot of that business, but it's beautifully made. It moves like a Sherman tank.
Good
and, you know.
Have you any idea what's going on in this country? They're not even bothering to dig graves anymore. They're simply feeding them to the crocodiles.
Nicholas, tell me what is on your mind.
I have to go home now.
You cannot. You are like my own son.
I'm Nicholas Garrigan, and I'm from Scotland.
Your home is here.
He's changed, hasn't he?
He has always been like this. You have to find a way to get out.
I am surrounded by traitors. The preachers say I am a man. The Americans, I am a cannibal. These are lies!
He's going to kill us, Nicholas.
Go home. Tell the world the truth about Amin. They will believe you. You are a white man.
I need to get out of here.
You earn your passage first.
You want me to kill him?
You want to kill me? I will not die.
You have grossly offended your father.
For all the films that upset you or were meant to upset you, talking of like grubby supermarkets and grubby estates, all that, I saw The Lives of the Saints, written by Tony Grassoni, who's been adapting Terry Gilliam films of late and co-wrote In This World for Michael Winterbottom. And this was set in some grimy sort of district of London, Tottenham, I think, or somewhere like that.
No, not Tottenham.
No, not Tottenham.
Any Tottenham listeners turn off now.
Or Enfield or somewhere like that. But the thing is, it's any part of, like, you know, Zone 2 or 3. I mean, I live in Zone 2, and it's very much like my part of the world. Yeah. But that was kind of uplifting. It added a touch of magical realism to the local proceedings. And you thought, actually, not every British kitchen sit drama needs to be depressing or worthy. This actually has some sort of angelic child fall from heaven and improve the lives of the locals. And it was
based on Othello? Sorry, I'm just looking.
Well,
at
I think, I don't know. I mean, it's weird. There seems to be this leitmotif throughout the reviews of Lives of the Saints that attribute this Shakespearean angle to it, and it's a lot subtler than people seem to think it is. I don't know if it's journalists reading the press notes and deciding what the film's about without actually watching it.
I saw one film about a grim estate called 1-to-1 in Germany, but there's also that features enough racial violence to keep me boilingly angry.
Well,
but
I saw
Mischief Night, which is set in I think Newcastle. It's the same. That's got exactly the same elements of there's like sort of child pregnancy. There's drug addiction. There's criminal gangs. There's racial tension. There's all this horrible stuff. But it's the bounciest film you'll see. I'm not entirely it's for the kind of Billy Elliot kind of East is East crowd. Yeah, if you want to see a film about all the horrible things in the world, but one that, you know, makes you leave with a smile on your face.
I think that's Shameless.
It is very similar to Shameless, and it's coming out very soon.
It's out very soon. We should say Romanzo Criminale is out tomorrow. Mischief Night is out imminently. Mm. And quite a few of the films we're talking about, some people won't get to see them because they won't get distribution.
Yeah.
But quite a few of them will.
That's the thing that makes me boil.
You know, but this is why it's so great to go to the London Film Festival, because you see really odd, obscure films, not because that's fashionable to see obscure, but I just want to see stuff that I wouldn't normally see. And that's wonderful, isn't it?
Absolutely. I've loved it that I've gone to see a bunch of random things which I wouldn't have seen otherwise, even when they were poor, even when they were, you know, really, really tedious. I'm glad I was there, although there is one film, and I'm very, very sad to say that it's the only film I saw directed by a woman, and it's called Fallen, and it comes from Austria, and I'm sorry that it was so bad, because I, as a woman, I wanted it to be really good.
Speaking for womankind.
For the whole of 3 billion women on the planet, now is your moment.
Oh, such a shame, this film. I mean, I don't want to... It wasn't particularly set in the same murky landscape that we've been describing, but it's about five women meeting at the funeral of a male teacher of theirs, of whom they were very fond. They haven't met for 14 years, and they're now in their early 30s, and they then spend 24 hours together having a bit of a reconciliation and just hanging out. And you know, that's all right, nothing wrong with that premise at all, but it's just so clunky, so badly made, loads and loads of close-ups where you think something incredibly significant is going to happen, and you're looking at the faces of these very photogenic actresses, and then nothing happens. And
isn't that the
keeps
same old story?
On
nothing
doing
happens.
That over and over again. Yeah. And it keeps on meaning to tell you, signalling that it's going to tell you that what the point of it all is. And one woman will say, so what's been happening to you in the last 14 years? And then it'll cut to something else completely different. And you'll wait for another half an hour for the rest of the conversation to follow up. And it's just such a shame that there are all these really good actresses in it. And, as I say, a woman director. And there you are. And nothing much really happens at all. It's so bleak. And it's so badly shot. I couldn't...
But it's done ironically,
just,
is it?
No! It's like it's just, you know,
can
here's
you shoot
a camera.
Something badly ironically?
You know, this kind of cinema verite, I've found in a lot of films recently, I've been saying, they're very interesting films, but there's this kind of trait in modern art house cinema at the moment to make things really drawn out beyond the beyond the point that's made.
Three films.
Sure. but, you know, there's this kind of almost malaise within modern cinema where you go, you could have had this drawn out to a reasonable amount, but actually you're drawing out double the time that we need to have it drawn out. A picture of, you know, I saw a film called Flanders, which is by what's his name, Mark?
Oh, 29 poems.
Yeah, French director, Dardenne or somebody like this. And it's just, the first half of the film is just tediously drawn out shots of people farming with combine harvesters and walking around and sitting there and staring into empty space. And that's fine if you're, you know, Andrei Tarkovsky, because you do it beautifully and there's a point to it, but it's kind of like, just give it a break. I'm sick of having this.
Did you see 29 Palms?
No.
Because I quite liked it, and nothing happens, really, for an hour and a half. But maybe it's because he accidentally pulled it off once by getting the right cast and the right location.
I thought that was the most idiotic.
Really? Oh, I enjoyed it.
That was nothing happens, nothing happens, nothing happens.
Sometimes
hideously violent thing happens.
Sometimes it's hard to explain why you like film, because, like I said, nothing much happens in 29 Palms. But it's maybe because he's got an engaging cast, he's got engaging locations, that he accidentally pulls it off. But when he tries to do it again, without good locations, without a good cast, it somehow doesn't work. I mean, it's this kind of undefinable thing. You know?
It also had the European trait of unpleasant sex, where nobody in European cinema has had any sex they've enjoyed for about the last 10 years.
Everybody
seems to be screaming in pain or agony or some kind of existential angst.
I've got to say, there was a, you know, half, again, like 29 Palms, because I haven't seen it, but I've heard this, that the first half is very tedious about rural life in Provence or somewhere, and then these three characters get taken over to an undefined war. It's kind of very Iraq-like. Mm. This is in the film Flanders. And then they get kind of brutalised by being soldiers. And there is a very horrible rape, gang rape in that. And it sounds like... And there's no kind of moral compass in this film. It's just kind of shown to you. And I don't know, sometimes I just feel like it's very easy to do something horror. About horror, about the horror of evil, and then just leave it and just go make up your own minds. That's a very easy touch, you know. Sometimes I want to, you know, see a film like, say, Funny Games. It's just, for me, highly moralistic film, which is one of the most controversial, shocking films in terms of violence I've ever seen. But you know that the director is trying to make a moral point here. With these films like Flanders, the director is Bruno Dumont, or Dumont. You know, it's kind of like, what are you... If you're not going to say anything,
it's got to be well done. It's got to have an angle. It's got to be well done. That's, I mean, you know, this Blimmin' Fallen film... It's got all the women are addicted to something or other, but it's not enough just to have a film about people who are addicted to things. We've seen people being addicted to things all the time. You know, there has to be some interesting way of showing why this is still an interesting subject.
There's a pretty good American independent film called Half Nelson, which is well worth a look. Mm. It's a bit drawn out, and it could have done with a bit snappier pacing. But it's about... It starts off with a premise that could make it one of the, you know, the most inspirational teacher I ever had kind of movies, except that, you know, about 15 minutes in, a young girl in the inspirational teacher's class finds him smoking crack in a...
Nice.
Is he smoking crack inspirationally?
It's a good angle, though. The crack addicted teacher, that's a really good angle.
I mean, he's on some kind of horrible downward spiral, and she might be turning into, you know, some kind of young dealer herself. But it's quite nice in that it completely avoids any Hollywood cliches at all. Where she, normally in films like this, they'll suddenly make the girl from the ghetto, they'll suddenly make her, I don't know, a violin virtuoso or have some kind of hidden talent or be a genius writer. They don't in this. She's just another girl. And the guy, again, the teacher is, I can't remember his name, Ryan Gosling. His genius performance of 27 Flavours of Wasted. So he's got to play... Guy doing normal cocaine, guy doing crack cocaine, guy hungover whilst teaching a class, guy drunk at a party. Pretty much, you know, every form of... But the entire film rests on his heavy eyelids. and, you know, he's great. It doesn't come to, you know, any like sort of startling conclusion, but there's this spirit of kind of hope and...
Hope? You know, some in the kind film of festival? No, you can't have hope.
There's a kind of vague reaching for redemption which doesn't make you reach for a sick bucket at the same time. So it's not the biggest recommendation of all time. It's well worth checking out Half Nelson.
That will probably be distributed and seen.
Yeah, I imagine. It's got a great soundtrack by Broken Social Scene as well. So
I'd like to mention... Going back to Alison's point about women directors, I saw a couple of really excellent movies by female directors.
Hurrah!
There's this film called Day Night. It's an unnamed suicide bomber. It's a very young girl of indeterminate race. And it's very good. Why are you laughing?
I don't know. The parade of grim, isn't it? It's like every film we bring it up is crack and suicide and terrorism and racial violence.
You just love it? Let's just, you know, just drown in our own nihilistic juices here. But no, it's a really well-made film. It's basically, there's no kind of, again... As I was saying about the film Flanders, where I felt that there wasn't any moral compass, I think there is with this, but it's not worn on its sleeve. It's very subtle. We don't know who this... Basically, the film is shot in a very cinema verite style. There's not a lot of dialogue, and it's very abstract and minimalistic, but it totally draws you in from the performances. This is a young girl who meets up with four hooded men in a hotel room in New York, and she's about to go on a suicide mission with a backpack full of explosives, and they go through all the kind of the tactics and the exercises that she needs to know to go and blow up a load of people in Times Square. And you follow her on her kind of the 24 hours before the bombing, and how she is kind of reacting and how she is sort of going into her own self-consciousness, thinking, should I be doing this or shouldn't I? And it's a superb sort of take on, you know, it doesn't give you any easy answers why. It's not going like, this is why suicide bombers do this. But it's just, it sort of brings you in. It kind of makes you complicit almost in what she's about to do.
Is she a Muslim girl?
She's kind of Muslim-esque. You know, there are Muslim-esque people. But, you know, the four hooded men who are getting her to do this are actually Americans. They're speaking in American. So there's no kind of easy pointers to who this might be for. Is it, you know, Palestinians? Is it this? Is it that? And I think that works because it's a universal kind of terrorist act. And it takes you into her head. And actually, I don't want to give the ending away, but there's a surprise ending, and it doesn't follow through how you would normally think. And and it really is quite a moralistic, for me, it was quite a moralistic film. To these aren't just total monsters. I totally disagree with terrorism, but they are human beings who've done this for a reason. We need to understand. And this is kind of, doesn't give you easy answers, but that's an interesting film, Day Nights, Day Night.
Okay.
And it's by a woman director called Julia Lochtev, which I don't know is German or French, I don't know.
Does the surprise ending involve fluffy kittens and dancing girls?
The surprise ending will be coming out on the DVD extras with the
In heaven, does she get waited on by seven naked male virgins?
But then there was another film which I won't go too much into, but called Requiem.
We're running out of time.
Requiem by Hans Christian Schmidt. Actually, that's not a woman, is it?
But he had female sensibilities.
Yeah, and that was a wonderful film about... that's going to come out soon because it's Soda Pictures, so that will be out. And it's about a Catholic, a young Catholic girl who was... it's based on a true story as well. She was brought up by a very Orthodox Catholic family, very strict, and in the 70s, and she... she started to hear voices and see visions, and they thought that she was possessed by a demon, and actually they ended up trying to exorcise these demons. She was just mentally unstable. Yeah, but it's done really well in a very social realistic manner, and she ended up basically dying from exhaustion from the exorcisms that her Catholic parents were sort of forcing her to do. And it's a very powerful take on mental illness, and also the kind of organized. It's a very good critique of organized religion, where it's become so disarming and it kind of takes away your freedom. And yeah, it's a very good film to look out for, Requiem.
Have we got time to talk about Babel quickly?
That's what I was going to say. Since we did talk about The Last King of Scotland, which was the opening film, it'd be nice to mention Babel, which was the closing film of the festival, and obviously one that will get a large release.
Fairly sharpish. You give it a go.
All right, then. Love Iñárritu's other works.
I didn't like 21 Grams.
Didn't you? I particularly loved Amores Perros, I must say.
I'll give you that.
And it's got similarities with Amores Perros and 21 Grams. If I can remember it that well. But it's all these three interlinked stories. It's about the universality of humanity in many ways. It's big. It's
huge.
Yes, it's a huge film. Brilliant actors, particularly the non-famous actors, I'd say. Brad Pitt's in it, and he's fine. And Kate Blanchett, and she's fine. But it's the people who aren't well-known who I think are particularly good, particularly the woman that plays Mexican nanny in it. She's fantastic.
She was in Amores Perros, I do believe.
Oh, is she? Yeah. Oh, God. I don't remember in that. She's fantastic. Oh, she's the mum in that. She yeah. She played a mum. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, she's got a big role in this. I probably can't remember the actor's his name, but look out for her. Lovely little middle-aged lady. It's. I came out thinking, feeling sort of anxious. Yet another film that I couldn't come out just feeling happy in an uninflected way. But I think there is hope in there, Mark. Would you say you come out thinking? There's some hope.
What we should mention is that
afterwards.
The stories that are all interacting are all astoundingly anxiety-inducing. And it intercuts between the most anxious moments, and then it will cut to another anxious moment and another one. And it builds and builds and builds until I think it kind of reaches a peak where I felt nervous exhaustion almost about the, it's about 2.5 hours long. So about 2 hours in, I just thought, I don't know if I can deal with this any longer. There's a beautiful story with a deaf-mute Japanese schoolgirl who... she's, you know, traumatised after the death of her mother, and she goes out for a night on the town. She's just kind of seeking affection in all the wrong places, and she's, she's taking pills. She's out with these guys, and you're just convinced that any moment now, the worst thing in the world is going to happen, and it's going to turn into Flanders or one of these other things. And I'm not going to say what happens, but the same with the Moroccan story, the same with the Mexican story, where people are lost in the desert and whatever. There's just this running kind of boiling tension, brilliant use of incredible silence or quiet, incredibly loud noise coming in. I bet you old age pensioners will be complaining about this film. And you know, I was deafened by the nightclub sequence. It's just, you know,
it covers so much territory, and it's brushing against terrorism. There's stuff about that. There's stuff about American heavy-handed empire building. There's racism. There's the stuff about love of parents for children and love of a surrogate parent, the nanny played by this lovely actress, for children. So there's loads and loads of stuff about children. There's lots and loads of stuff about sex. There's stuff about sex as a displacement activity for real love. It's touching on all these great human themes.
Well, as the title suggests, it's mainly about communication or lack of communication or cross signals, or everybody in it is just failing to do what they really mean, or lying, or trying to escape the truth, and that is one of those things which makes you anxious at the best of times. And what can I say? It wakes.
It's very good.
I do think, you know, if they'd stopped the film at about 2 hours in, when I was feeling that, because it was one of the few films at the festival that really made me feel something. I was gripping my seat.
Really.
Yeah. I was, you know, stunned by it. I think if they'd stopped it at an earlier point, I'd walk out saying it was the best goddamn thing I've ever seen. But
so Brad Pitt didn't ruin
it. No. He's fine in it because he's playing somebody. You can't really go wrong with that part. It's somebody being anxious about his wife being shot, and
it's a small part.
It's a fairly small part. Yeah.
It's not that these big stars take over in any way.
Yeah, but I would have. You know, I love. You know, really, really, completely recommended it. Had it, you know, finished after, because after a certain point, you just can't keep up that level of anxiety, and you have to have a reaction against the film, or I just end up like going, oh, for God's sake, you know, please bring this stuff to some kind of conclusion. And it has a beautiful conclusion, I think, and a fairly oblique, hopeful one, I think.
Cool,
but. Yeah.
Massively accomplished.
Yeah.
So that's definitely one to look out for.
Yes.
Right. Well, I would like to thank my guests, James, Mark and Alison, for valuable insight about the many films that are on at the film festival and will hopefully be coming out in regular cinemas in the months and weeks to come, or at least will be able to import on DVD from America and elsewhere.
Next week, in the first of two belated Halloween specials, I'm talking to Emma Smart about film adaptations of Stephen King's novels.